If you will, please come to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to the October 27th, 2022 meeting of the City of Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals. This is a quasi-judicial proceeding. All those wishing to give testimony during these proceedings will please sign in. Witnesses will be sworn in prior to giving testimony. All proceedings of the Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals are recorded. Decisions of the Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals are final. Challenges to the decisions of the Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals must be filed through the Superior Court of Chatham County. I ask you, if you have any cell phones or noise-making devices, please silence them at this time. And join me in the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance. Father, we just thank you for a time to come together today to do the business of the city. We ask you, Lord, give us wisdom and help us to make right decisions. Lord, guide us and lead us. And Father, thank you for the privilege of being allowed to live here in such a beautiful city. Lord, I ask your blessings on the marriages and families of Savannah and Chatham County. In Jesus' name, amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Before we do anything else, I want to announce that none of the bathrooms in the building are working. So don't go looking for one because they're out of order. I think somebody's working on that as we speak. Yeah, we have two items that are requested to be removed from the final agenda. That's 2317 Waters Avenue. It's a variance to the minimum parking requirements, 22-004075, and a variance request for Lawton Avenue, file number 22-004538 for parking and height variance. Do I hear a motion to remove these items from the final agenda?
Motion to remove.
Okay, Mrs. Jones has made a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Mrs. Jarrett, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Evans? Oh, excuse me, Mr. Evans isn't here. Mr. Plump?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Hall, are you online?
Yes, I am, and I vote yes.
You vote yes?
Correct.
All right, and Mrs. Jones?
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes, and these items will be removed from the final agenda. Next, we have the minutes for the September 22nd, 2022 meeting. Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Motion by Mr. Plunk. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jarrett, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Evans? I mean, Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Hall?
Yes.
And Mrs. Jones?
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes and the minutes are approved. There's an item under old business. The applicant is not able to be here today and has requested that this be continued till next month's meeting. Is there a motion to continue request for 605 Siler Avenue, file number 22-004056?
Move to approve.
Mrs. Jarrett has made a motion to continue this item to next month. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jarrett, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Hall?
Yes.
And Mrs. Jones?
Yes.
All right. Motion is approved and that item will be continued till next month. All right, before we begin, if you plan on speaking or giving testimony here today, if you're online or in the room, if you will, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I do solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. Okay. We're going to hear the variance request for 230 Vernonburg Drive, file number 22-003568. This is an accessory building in a front yard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me open this up. So this is a request from 230 Vernonburg Road. Here's the vicinity map. I'd be able to say a little bit better here. This is White Bluff Road. This is actually in the city limits of Savannah, but sort of right on the edge before it does become Vernonburg over here. So what the applicant is doing here, this probably is a better picture. So currently the property looks like this. The applicant has submitted a subdivision request and they would like to split the property here. Currently there's an existing home on the right and there is an existing barn over here. They are wanting to put a future house on this property on the left, and due to the shape of the property, there isn't really room to do it in front of where the barn is. Typically, accessory buildings like a barn have to go in the rear of a house. So they are requesting a variance to be able to essentially place a home behind an existing structure. The existing barn structure, you can kind of see the layout here from the road, but there's a split driveway that runs here and feeds into both of these homes, or will feed into this home and then this one as well. This is the existing barn, as I said, and here's the existing home. Future home will be somewhere there in the back. So a few notes. We do not find this variance request to be detrimental to public health or safety. The shape of the property is peculiar and it's inconsistent with the surrounding properties. After surveying the neighborhood, we found that this barn is very visually in keeping with the homes and the structures on this road. There are also a lot of homes that are pushed pretty far back from the road here, usually around 100 feet. So there's not really a pattern of having homes close up to the front either that we would need to look at. This would be a single family residence too, by the way. We do find that the applicant is being deprived of rights commonly enjoyed by others in the neighborhood. There are a number of accessory buildings in the front of homes around this area. The Vernonburg area, as you know, has a unique rural character to it. Whether it's, you know, technically in the city limits of Savannah or not, it's more of a rural area, larger lots, more open space. Houses are pushed a little bit farther back and the accessory buildings are a little bit more spread out and I don't want to say haphazard, but we do find that the variance would help the owner enjoy the same rights that are already being enjoyed by others in the area. So we are recommending approval for this variance request.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for staff? All right, hearing none, would the applicant please come forward?
Oh, you're up.
I'm sorry, I'm a little late.
For Vernonburg.
Oh, yes, okay. All right.
Excuse me, sir. If you will, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
I swear to tell the whole truth, so help me God.
Okay, if you will, state your name for the record and please sign in.
Anthony Consul.
We're doing I don't think we have the sign sheet up here, but you can get that after.
Okay, I'll make sure to sign afterwards.
Please do. Do you have anything?
I'm for this one too.
If you will, please, you have anything you'd like to say?
No, just that I've worked with Miss Beam and for a long time, and this is a family piece of property for her here. And she's Tom Bolton's been very instrumental in helping us figure out how to this subdivision approved and everything. And we feel like it's that's her properties to the right and to the left of it also. And she's want to build a structure for herself next to her existing house. And other than that, we feel like it's a good plan we put forward, and we hope that y'all agree with us on that.
Okay. Are there any questions for the applicant? All right. Thank you so much. Is there any members of the public that would like to speak concerning this petition? If you're online, if you use the raise your hand feature, we'd be glad to recognize you. All right, we'll enter into board discussion then. Mrs. Jarrett, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No, thanks.
Mr. Evans?
No, thank you.
Mr. Plump?
No, sir.
Mr. Condon? Okay. Mr. Hall, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No.
Mrs. Jones?
No.
Well, would anyone like to make a motion concerning this petition?
A motion that we accept staff's recommendation to approve petitioner's request.
All right, Mr. Plunk has made a motion to approve the petitioner's request as per staff's recommendation. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion on the motion? All right, Mrs. Jarrett, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Hall?
Yes.
Mrs. Jones?
Yes.
Okay, the motion is approved and the variance request is granted. All right, next, we're going to hear the petition 336 Barnard Street. This is an appeal to the zoning administrator's determination of a zoning confirmation letter related to the location of a building's primary entrance when situated on a tithing block, 22-004378.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and board members. Melissa Leto, MPC staff. This item is an appeal. Mr. Andrew Jones, agent for 120 West Jones LLC, is appealing the zoning confirmation letter written by the City of Savannah Zoning Administrator's Office regarding 336 Barnard Street. Christian Sautil, the architect for the new single-family residence at 336 Barnard Street, requested and received a zoning confirmation letter on August 12, 2022, in order to clarify the building's primary entrance when situated on a tithing block. In review of the ordinance, Article Section 7.8.10 GII 1, the zoning administrator made a determination that subsection A through F does not apply to this property. And this is the section that I'm referring to, where it goes to locations within a tithing block, trust lots. Is a building on a trust lot facing a square shall locate its primary entrance to front the square. That's A, and then AII. A building on a trust lot not facing a square shall locate its primary entrance so that it fronts the same street as other contributing buildings on the same block. And B is the issue at hand, tithing blocks, which are a component of Oglethorpe's plan of Savannah. Tithing blocks are located on the north-south side of a square and usually consist of five 60-foot by 90-foot lots. And then subsection C, Broughton Street, a building on Broughton Street shall locate its entrances at no greater intervals than 50 feet, provided, however, that for a corner entrance, the interval to this next entrance may be increased to 60 feet. Subsection D, north of Broughton Street, a corner building located adjacent to a north-south service street shall have an entrance on the service street. Subsection E, east-west connecting street, a building along an east-west connecting street fronting a square shall have entrances at intervals and not to exceed 50 feet. Subsection F, corner entrance, an angled entrance shall only be permitted at intersections of streets or lanes. The zoning administrator determined that subsection B, as well as the subsections through F, do not apply to 336 Barnard Street. As a result, the determination was that subsection G does apply, and that is, if none of the above conditions apply, the building entrance shall be consistent with contributing buildings within the context. I'm going to show a map here. Let me minimize it. So this is a map of contributing structures on tithing blocks with entrances facing a north-south street. Right here in red, over in this area is the subject property, 336 Barnard Street. And then they have highlighted in purple contributing structures and then in yellow non-contributing structures. There are approximately 14 non-contributing buildings with entrances facing a north-south street indicated into this map here. Per Article 3 of the Savannah Zoning Ordinance, appeals shall be considered as follows. And I'm going to bring that up for your information. The Zoning Board of Appeals shall determine whether the zoning and confirmation letter in this appeal request and the determination of this ordinance. The Zoning Board of Appeals may reverse or affirm wholly or in part, or may modify the determination being appealed, and shall make a determination that in its opinion ought to be made in the case before it, unless otherwise specified by this ordinance. To this end, the Zoning Board of Appeals shall have all of the powers of the administrative official, commission, or board for whom the appeal is taken. A motion to reverse, affirm, or modify the determination by the zoning administrator of the City of Savannah appealed shall include a statement of the specific reasons, including the proposed findings of fact that support the decision. The findings of fact shall be based on the same evidence received by the zoning confirmation letter. D, if a motion to reverse or modify is not made, or such motion fails to receive the affirmative vote of a majority of the members present, then the appeal shall be denied. And finally, E, the appellant shall have the burden of proof. And these are actions by the Zoning Board of Appeals that you should be considering. And then finally, this is the purview of the Zoning Board of Appeals. Based on the information provided in the report and the public hearing, the Board of Appeals shall make a finding as to the applicant's appeal. Such decision shall be based on whether or not the determination by the City of Savannah Zoning Administrator erred in the zoning confirmation letter or interpretation of the ordinance. The burden of proof for any such error is on the appellant. Thank you. And the petitioner is here to speak as well.
Are there any questions for staff? No questions. I got a question for you. This particular lot we're talking about is indeed a tithing lot?
Yes, sir.
Okay, even though it was a tithing lot before it was divided, and it is still considered a tithing lot, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. Would the applicant please come forward, state your name for the record?
Do you have anything?
Yes, there is.
Hello, my name is Andrew Jones,
and I'm here as the authorized agent for 120 West Jones, LLC. And I did send a presentation. Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to present this appeal to you. This is an appeal by 120 West Jones LLC of the determination of the zoning administrator relative to section 7, 8, 10, of the zoning ordinance. In this presentation, I refer to it as the zoning determination. Its number is referenced below, and the staff here refers to it as the zoning confirmation letter, but we're all speaking to the same document. On behalf of 120 West Jones Street, we seek two remedies reflecting the staff report. The first is to reverse the zoning determination and void the COA, which was based on the zoning determination. And secondly, as an addition or as an alternative, to modify the zoning determination to clarify that it does not, on its own terms, exempt 336 Barnard Street from the provision in question, and therefore, again, void the certificate of appropriateness. As background, as we saw, 336 Barnard is in the rear half of the subdivided lot, formerly known as 123 West Charlton Street. So you can see that in the map, the purple being 123 West Charlton Street and 336 Barnard being the back half of the subdivided lot. They're in a tithing block outlined in blue. In 2020, after a subdivision of the lot, 336 Barnard applied for a Part 1 COA for a single family structure, which was granted. And the main entrance of the proposed structure, which you see on the right, it's a spec house that was advertised on Zillow. The main entrance faces Barnard Street, not Charlton Street, which is the east-west street. In the August 10th hearing for part two, public comment included that the entrance on Barnard Street rather than Charlton Street violated section 7810G21B, the provision in question here. The hearing was continued to September 14th, in part on that basis. In the meantime, on August 17th, 336 Barnard obtained the zoning determination, which concluded that section B did not apply. A member of the public, myself, filed an appeal of the zoning determination on August 30th, and the city withdrew the appeal on September 9th without notice to me or any discussion with me. The withdrawal, however, was communicated to MPC staff prior thereto, just in time for the staff notes for the September 14th hearing. Partly on the basis that the appeal was no longer active, the MPC staff and the review board applied the zoning determination to proof part two on September 14th. And the report that was just read to you by staff includes the statement that COA was approved based on this zoning confirmation letter, what we call the determination letter. Subsequently, on around September 15th, the applicants here today at 120 West Jones LLC filed this appeal of the zoning determination, leveraging all the arguments that were in the appeal that I had made that was denied. And the reason it was denied was apparently I'm too far away from an affected structure. My buildings are 322, 324 East Broughton Street and 41 Habersham Street. But under the terms of the zoning determination, that determination affects every lane building in Savannah by its terms. It is not restricted to 336. I therefore own a building affected by it, so my property interests are affected, and I'm surrounded by three developable lots that are also affected by the zoning determination. So my distance from an affected building under the zoning determination is 0 feet. You can't get any closer. But that appeal was denied. I was advised to file an appeal of the letter of denial. I did. That was also turned down through the city attorney, mischaracterizing it as an appeal of an appeal. No, it was an appeal of a letter from Ms. Liddy's office denying my right of appeal. It was not an appeal of an appeal. And there's been a fourth appeal filed of the certificate of appropriateness. And the city attorney is trying to stop that appeal also, again, by mischaracterizing the content of the appeal. And all that information is in the exhibits in the rear. So the first request that we make under the view of reversing the zoning determination is to reverse it because it construed the ordinance incorrectly. Recognize that a correct reading of 336 Barnard as designed is not permitted, that the correct reading is that 336 is not permitted. So here we have the provisions on the right in the box. These are the provisions in section 87810 of the Downtown Savannah Historic District Overlay pertaining to the location of entrances and doors. The short section at the top is for existing buildings because a lot of existing buildings don't conform. But their lack of conformity to the Oglethorpe plan was clearly not a precedent for future construction. You know, bad things happened in the past, but future construction is held to a much higher standard, which is the section that begins with new construction. And that was the provision that staff read item by item. And you can see that each of these is based upon where the project is going to be located. Is it in a trust lot? Is it in a tithing block? Is it north of Broughton Street, et cetera? And then there's a catch-all at the bottom, which is section G, and we'll get to that in a moment. But the highlighted section on the lower right, tithing blocks. So it refers to the entire block. We don't care about lots, subdivisions. If you're a subdivision, you're in a block. A building on a tithing block shall locate its primary entrance to front the east-west street. That's pretty clear. That's very simple language in the east-west street being Charlton Street, not Barnard Street. So this is a reference to blocks. It's not a reference to sublots. It's not a reference to parcels, which is the language that the zoning determination used. It doesn't reference subdivisions. It doesn't reference accessory lane structures. And you will likely hear arguments that bring up all that terminology in order to confuse you. but none of that terminology is there. It's just about a tithing block. And this provision reflects the context for NUZO. In 2018, the National Park Service issued a report placing Savannah's downtown historic district in threatened status, one step from emergency status. The Oglethorpe Plan, right in the 1734 Peter Gordon map, is a key component of the designation status per the 1966 designation. And it's that designation that matters, not any subsequent interpretations of the Oglethorpe Plan or theories or revisionist theories. It has to do with that designation. One of the first threats cited by the National Park Service was the overdevelopment of the lanes as set forth on page 52 of the report, Exhibit B. You can see it in the exhibits. It includes a photograph of a principal building and a lane building in a courtyard, which they reference as Bull Street, but it's actually Barnard Street. It's actually one block away from the subject property. And in that report, the first threat they cited to the district was the filling in of the voids between the principal building and the lane, which is exactly what Barnard does. NUZO, effective in 2019, includes some proposals to strengthen the protection of the Oglethorpe Plan, explicit provisions to preserve the lanes and so on, as well as 7810G21B, the subject of the zoning determination. This section ensures that no building in a tithing block, even a building at the back of a lot, faces the north-south street. Rather, it has to face the east-west. The orientation of a building is a fundamental component of the Oglethorpe Plan. You can see right there, that is a tithing block, and all the buildings face the east-west street, even the little carriage house in the back. None of them face the north-south street. In construing the ordinance, Section B reflects the general construction of all the other parallel provisions. In each, there is a condition. Where is this proposal of yours going to be? And then there is a shall clause, and the shall clause is the mandatory part that says you must do this. So the condition, are you in a trust lot, or are you in a tithing block, or are you in Broughton Street, are you on a corner, so on, or are you none of the above, because there are some properties in the downtown historic district that aren't in the Oglethorpe Plan. So for example, a lot of the properties to the west of MLK are not in tithing lots or trust lots. So there has to be a catch-all, and that catch-all is really broad language. It just says you have to be compatible with conforming properties, which is pretty easy to meet if you meet all the other ones above. So basically, as I said, Section G is the broad catch-all provision, only requiring consistency with contributing buildings, and B is the one that specifically addresses tithing blocks. So consequently, the appellant seeks a finding from the Zoning Board of Appeals that 336 Barnard cannot be built as proposed with the front door on Barnard Street because it does not meet the requirements for new construction. Accordingly, reverse the zoning determination, void the COA, and require 336 Barnard to submit a new COA application. The basic principle here is if your proposed building does not meet the historic review standard for new construction, then you must redesign it in order to meet the standard, or you can always keep the existing building that you purchased as is. Now, some opponents are going to argue that the proposed building is better than the existing cinder block building on the site. I think we can all agree to that. While that may be true, it's not relevant to the question before the board today. The question for the board today is whether the proposed building, which violates the zoning ordinance, can be built, or instead must be revised so that it meets the requirements of the ordinance. And given the possible redesign of the building to meet the terms of the ordinance, any new proposal must come before the review board so that the public can weigh in. It should not be approved in another closed door process, such as the zoning determinations closed door process. Request two, reverse the zoning determination because it is based on erroneous reasoning. Two sides of every argument, so let's explore this other side. It says that the whole provision is written in a way that the regulatory language that the building in a tithing block shall locate its primary entrance to front the east-west street is the condition. Therefore, G exempts those parcels that cannot locate the primary entrance on an east-west street from the requirement. I mean, is that clear? I find that really hard to construe. But after reading it many, many, many times, here's what I think the zoning administrator is trying to say. Section G begins if none of the above conditions apply. You see that down at the bottom. So the zoning administrator is arguing that the entirety of B both the site condition, tithing block, and the shall clause, the operative mandatory provision, that entire thing is the condition. But this reading is incorrect because clearly, as we've seen from the construction of the statute and all of the parallel provisions, that the conditions are the locations. And then to make things even weirder, the zoning administrator adds a possibility test, which is not in the language of the ordinance. I mean, this ordinance was passed with public input and public review, and now magically from nowhere in hiding comes a possibility test. And this possibility test is very important here because it's what the zoning administrator needs to determine whether the proposed construction is subject to B, is not subject to B, and therefore falls under G. So here's the language. It's the determination of the zoning administrator that any proposed construction on a tithing block may locate its primary entrance in the North South Street location, blah, 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 when the location on the East-West Street is not possible, provided it is consistent with contributing buildings within the context. So the contributing buildings within the context is that section G. So if it's not possible, you fall to section G. One big problem is that, as we've seen, when this is applied, the applicant's not required to prove that it's not possible. No proof. You just say, can't do it. My design doesn't allow for it. Therefore, it's not possible. So you can design things that don't fit the ordinance, and then you can say, oh, based on my design, it's just not possible to meet the ordinance. There's no one determining whether that possibility is truly met by the facts. So what the administrator's reading means is that B does not apply if it's not met. So B applies. If you meet it, hunky dory. If you don't meet it, who cares? You're exempt and you fall to G. So this reading shows that section B is just utterly meaningless. And that's exactly how it's been applied. But note, every section includes a condition followed by the shall clause. Therefore, the administrator's erroneous reading of the statute implies that G negates A through F for any applicant who just asserts that it can't comply. As a result, the zoning administrator's nullified A through F. In such case, all that matters is G. This implies that sections A through F were intended by the drafters of New ZO to be utterly meaningless. Is this an interpretation that makes sense to you? While the zoning administrator certainly has the authority to issue an interpretation, a so-called interpretation that renders the law meaningless has to be void. Three, reverse the zoning determination because the zoning administrator should not have the power to nullify or render meaningless any provision of any existing or future ordinance. If this stands, the administrator can nullify laws in a closed door proceeding. And this is really important in today's context. There is an effort by a number of stakeholders to enact new laws to ensure that 336 Barnard never happens again. In response to the approval of 336 Barnard, the National Park Service issued a letter on September 26 calling out 336 Barnard Street as having an incrementally negative effect on the already threatened status of the district. And that letter is also in one of the exhibits. Note that if it were not for the erroneous zoning determination and the intervention of Ms. Letty in blocking the original appeal, 336 Barnard probably could not have been approved, and the NPS would not have issued its letter. However, it did. And in response to the letter, the MPC held a meeting on November 17th at the request of the review board to address this threat, including issues about tithing lots. The result of the meeting was a list of recommendations to amend the ordinance in order to undo the damage that the zoning administrator had just caused. But if the zoning determination stands, the zoning administrator will be free to use erroneous reasoning to undermine these new provisions as well. Any future corrections to the ordinance will be pointless, and there will be little left to stop the loss of the historic district status. So, also, another argument, reverse the zoning determination because its application goes far beyond its intended scope of addressing 336 Barnard. Notably, the city now applies it to all similarly situated buildings, such as 301 West York Street, which of course then would have suggested that I'm standing to file this appeal on my own behalf. And there are the staff recommendations for 301 West York Street. You can see they quoted the zoning determination, and they also cited the denial of my original appeal as a justification for pushing through 301 West York Street, which builds solidly back through the lane and is in violation of Section B. The city doesn't even require the applicant to prove that compliance is not possible. So there's a possibility test, but all you have to do is assert it. You don't actually have to prove it. And of course, the city is refusing to allow aggrieved parties for other affected buildings to appeal. So it's the application of this that's dangerous. I mean, this is something that if you don't stop it now, there's a whole pipeline of these projects will go through as we're trying simultaneously to convince the National Park Service that everything is okay. Reverse the zoning determination because it nullifies a law without public notice or review, resulting in a lack of governmental transparency and accountability. While the enactment of new ZO was a public process subject to public review and input, the zoning determination and its little secret possibility test was not. It was a closed door process that did not allow the public to weigh in on facts or reasoning. Thus, a private closed door process was wrongfully used to undermine a law that had been passed with public review. Reverse the zoning determination because it gives the appearance of impropriety. Savannah is a small town, and many of us know each other from other associations. There's really only 1 or 2 degrees of separation between all the people in this room. But given the closed door nature of the zoning determination process, it should be noted that Mr. Brad Bow serves on the board of the Savannah Development Renewal Authority, an esteemed organization of which I think some of board members are involved with as well, highly respected organization, but it also coincidentally happens to be the place where Ms. Liddy worked for approximately 6 years. Further, the letter denying the original appeal of the zoning determination was issued by Ms. Liddy, whose department was also responsible for the zoning determination. Denying an appeal of one's own action certainly gives the appearance of a conflict of interest. Now, again, I'm talking about appearances, not talking about the substance or what actually went on, but sometimes things just look bad, and that itself is a bad thing. Moreover, the denial of the appeal was communicated to the MPC staff well before being communicated to me, the appellant, who first found out from the MPC agenda. Such actions imply an overwhelming degree of favoritism in pushing through the approval of the project. So yes, the Savannah Development Renewal Authority is an esteemed organization and does great work. But that doesn't mean that there should be favoritism towards board members to enrich them at the expense of the status of the historic district. Finally, Ms. Liddy has also been involved in blocking 2 additional appeals, resulting in a total of as many as 4 instances of intervening on behalf of 336 Barnard for the personal benefit of Mr. Bow. 7, modify. So all of those arguments before are arguments about reversing the determination. In addition or in lieu of, you have the authority to modify it. So the next request is modify the zoning determination to clarify that it doesn't actually render a conclusion on 336 Barnard. You can read it through back and forth. It's addressed to 336 Barnard, but its actual operative language never makes a final determination on 336 Barnard. Just as a note, the zoning determination was for a 3-family, 4-family structure. The actual building here is a 1-family. So it's not actually addressing the building that we're talking about. You can even see under permissible uses, the zoning administrator cited 3- to 4-family. But more importantly, the zoning determination, while it was addressed to 336 Barnard, does not conclude whether it is not possible for 336 Barnard to comply, nor does it say who should make that determination. It just leaves it open. So the zoning determination does not tie everything together. It can't serve as the basis for the approval of the COA. The 8th request is to modify the determination to say explicitly that it does not apply to 336 Barnard because it is possible for 336 Barnard to comply based on its own filings. What you see here is in 2017, Venera Gardens applied for a COA for 4 townhouses in the rear of 123 West Charlton Street, also known as 336 Barnard. The townhouses had entrances facing the east-west street and no entrance facing the north-south street. They therefore met the requirements of Section B. The MPC had recommended some changes to the townhouses. They were too tall, too wide, incrementally, but for some reason, Venera Gardens chose not to comply with those requests and I guess just didn't follow through with this plan. Brad Bau, the sole member of Venera Gardens, was also the declarant of the 123 West Charlton condos and is also the sole member of 336 Barnard LLC, the current owner of the rear of the lot by a quitclaim deed. But you can see in these pictures, especially the middle one, do you see there's a path? The top is Charlton Street, and there's a path in the yard in the common areas for the condo, and that path leads to the building in the rear. So if the doors on the rear building face east-west, they have an entrance on the east-west street. So what you've got here is something that completely conforms to the law. It must have been doable because they filed it themselves. They nearly got MPC approval, except for a couple of tweaks. Request 9, modify the zoning determination, say it does not apply to 336 Barnard because it can comply based on the condo declaration. And I've included sections of the condo declaration for 123 West Charlton Street, filed by declarant Venera Gardens, Brad Bau, sole member. In the declaration of the condo, the rear portion of the lot is defined as additional property. And section 26 of the declaration allows Venera Gardens LLC as declarant to add, and they've got a 7-year period after 2019, so we've got a number of years to resolve this, that they can add the additional property to the condo. It becomes part of the condo, it becomes a condo unit, all the common areas of the condo become a common area for the new unit, therefore the new unit has access to Charlton Street, and again, everything is solved. So that's within their power. And it's interesting because they might have thought about this even though they're not telling us, because the common area already has the address 336 Barnard Street, and I've given the PIN number for anybody who wants to look that up on the Board of Assessor Records. So the bottom line is that they proposed a project that conforms, all of their legal documentation allows them to build a project that conforms, but instead they don't want to. They don't want to conform with the zoning ordinance. And instead, they were able to get this zoning determination that doesn't follow the letter of the law. It creates law and it nullifies law. And it uses absurd reasoning to extend favors to Mr. Bau at the risk of our historic district status. And that's something that I don't think we can stand for. 10, and this is the end, demand that the three appeals currently being blocked by the city be forwarded immediately to the ZBA. Clarify that it's the role of the ZBA to determine standing so that such a decision occurs in a public forum where the appellant can establish the facts and make an argument for standing. Right now, the city attorney just makes up stuff and then denies standing. And I have emails in the back where I email the city attorney who tried to claim I didn't even own my own property. That was interesting because the city bills me taxes for it. And there's a citizen doesn't have any rights. You can't actually argue that you have standing. They just won't answer your emails. Clarify that it's not appropriate for the zoning administrator and or the city attorney to work in a closed door proceeding to conclude on issues of standing. And condemn the current practice whereby the zoning administrator and or the city attorney intentionally mischaracterize the nature of an appeal in order to block it and deny the appellant any means of redress. And remember that had the original appeal been forwarded to the ZBA, had it been successful, 336 Barnard would not have proceeded and the National Park Service would not have had to issue a letter saying that there's an incremental threat to the district. And this is the summary of the remedy sought: reverse the zoning determination, avoid the COA, because the determination construes the ordinance incorrectly. 336 Barnard under the terms of the ordinance is not permitted. The determination is based on erroneous reasoning. The administrator should not have the power to nullify laws. The application goes far beyond its intended scope, and it nullifies a law without public notice or review, resulting in a lack of governmental transparency and accountability, and it gives the appearance of impropriety. and/or modify the zoning determination to say it does not exempt 336 Barnard from Section B and void the COA. It certainly, by its own words, does not render a conclusion on 336 Barnard. And furthermore, we know that this applicant cannot even meet the possibility test because they've already proven it to us through their filings for a carriage house structure and their filings in the declaration of condo. And then please demand that the appeals currently being blocked by the city be forwarded to the ZBA so that the appellants can make arguments about their standing in a public forum where the facts can be addressed. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Are there any questions for the applicant? Okay, we can revisit that later. Any questions?
All right. I do.
Go ahead, Mr. Evans. Or is that Mr. Hall?
It was me. I'm sort of thinking through what I want to
take your time.
Understand here. Mr. Jones, is it your position that any construction on this lot should face West Charlton Street, or that the entrance should face West Charlton Street to the north?
Correct. Okay. That is the clear language in the ordinance, and it's completely doable, and the filings for the carriage house have shown that it's completely doable.
You agree with me that the lot itself doesn't have frontage on West Charlton Street?
No, but it has access to the path, and as I showed in the condo documents, it is Brad Bow who has the authority to add it to the condo and have access to that path, or he could negotiate an easement to the street. And that was the filing that you saw.
When you say it has access to the path, what do you mean by what path are you referring to?
The path is in the plat. And here you see the path. You see that in the middle? So there's a path that leads from this building to Charlton Street.
An existing sidewalk.
Yes. And the gate.
Part of the improvements, not part of the sort of legal title to the lot, but just the physical improvements, the sidewalk itself.
I'm not sure what your question is.
I was just trying to clarify what the path was, but you're just saying it's the physical sidewalk.
If there's a physical sidewalk and it constitutes a common area of the condo. The condo declaration was initially for the building in the front, which is 5 units. And there's a dotted line for the subdivision, and the common area includes a path up to the subdivision line. But under Section 26 of the condo declaration, they have the option of adding the rear portion to the condo. It becomes another unit. And then as a unit of the condo, that's its common area. Now, it's not going to have a private path. This is not a private path where they have exclusive control over it. It's a shared path with the other unit owners in the condo. But it does mean that it can, that the entrance, the main entrance, can face the east-west street.
Okay, so at present, 336 Barnard has not been submitted to the condominium declaration.
No, the declaration dates from September 9th, 2019, and there are sections of it in the appendix, and I have more pages of it here if you would like to see.
The answer is no, it has not been submitted to the condominium regime at this point in time.
I believe it has. I believe it's been a valid they've sold the condo units.
My question is, has 336 Barnard been submitted to the condominium regime?
No, 336 Barnard has not. The only argument here is that in meeting the possibility test, it is entirely possible for them to conform with this ordinance. They can do lots of different things with this property, but one of them is certainly, or a couple of them are options that would meet the terms of the zoning ordinance.
Right now, you're saying the declarant on 123 West Charlton shares common ownership with 336 Barnard?
Yes. Brad Bow is the declarant, is the sole member of Venera Gardens LLC.
Okay.
He is also the sole member of 336 Barnard, and therefore he controls both the actions of the declarant under the declaration of condo, so he can decide to make that decision. And he can decide what to do with 336 Barnard, which he is also the sole member.
All right. So when you suggest that it would be possible for 336 Barnard to have frontage access to West Charlton Street. That is either by virtue of submission to the condominium, which is at the discretion of the current condominium association or declarant, or negotiating an easement with that owner to cross the condominium property. Those are the two possibilities.
Yeah, those are the two possibilities. The latter one being if that additional property is not added to the condo.
So either way, it requires some discretion of the current owner of the 123 Charlton condominium regime.
Not the owner, the declarant. So that's what's interesting. These provisions are very explicit. I mean, there's an incredible amount of power the declarant has to add property for 7 years. They can do all sorts of things.
Sure.
So it's a large degree of power.
Right, but those declarant's rights are freely alienable. Mr. Bao could sell that or assign that at any point in time. Is that right?
That I don't have an answer to that question, whether he can sell them off or not, and I'm not sure why that's particularly relevant here.
Well, to me, it's relevant, and I'm because as I see it, it seems like Mr. Bao, as declarant, has to take some action to give Mr. Bao, as owner of 336, rights to West Charlton.
Yeah, he has to get his own approval.
I'm sorry?
He has to get approval from himself.
Right. And those could be two different people. He could, in fact, sell that property. It could be someone else who might not grant that.
They could, but right now they're the same person.
Right. So as it presently sits, 336 Barnard has no legal rights to access directly access West Charlton.
But Brad Bao does.
Okay. And has no frontage on West Charlton.
But he can if he chooses to. So the question here is on possibility test.
If the question is, shall locate its primary residence on the front of the east-west street, and the reasoning was there's no frontage on east-west street, you would agree that presently there is no frontage on the east-west street?
Correct, but the possibility test is not met because there is the possibility of locating it on the east-west street. Furthermore, to say that as an owner, I don't have access anymore to the east-west street because I made the decision not to have access to the east-west street because I made a lot of money that way. And now I made a bad decision. I don't have access to the east-west street anymore. So I don't want the laws to apply to me. I mean, this is a problem of his own making. And I don't see any reason why there should be an interpretation that nullifies the law because a guy made a decision that he no longer liked. And he does have options on how to get out of it. I mean, he's created this problem for himself and he could get out of it himself.
Your interpretation of the possibility test is that if it's possible by means of an adjacent property, that's what you're arguing.
Yes, if it's possible by means of the adjacent property that,
so
you, all,
were separate
that
owners,
you already control.
Well, but
all the same person.
That's mere coincidence. If we're applying the possibility test uniformly in every circumstance, it may not be that you have common owners between adjacent properties. And so if we're applying the possibility test, it's certainly possible for any owner to buy out the owner to the north and obtain. I think you're expanding the possibility test beyond what it can reasonably mean to suggest it's possible within the bounds of the legal rights of the property owner.
Well,
it's mere coincidence.
I think there's a distinction to draw. It's a good point. If you don't own the other property and you have no control over it, and it's owned by a completely different third party, and you've got to negotiate ab initio and start negotiating a price, that would be a completely different circumstance.
Which could happen tomorrow.
That could. So that would be a reason to modify the zoning determination and clarify exactly what this possibility test is. But also keep in mind, the possibility test is not in the zoning ordinance. So if you're doing this modification, what you're actually doing is amending the zoning ordinance without the public input. It would be a lot simpler here just to follow the terms of the zoning ordinance, which are really clear, instead of trying to deal with this possibility test that was never in the ordinance in the first place. But you do bring up an important distinction, assuming you're going to buy into amending the law effectively to add this possibility test.
So the question with regard to whether this is possible, that issue arose at the time of subdivision of the lot, correct?
No, that this possible language dates from the zoning determination. I don't believe that it exists anywhere in the MPC approval of the subdivision. I have read those notes.
No, what I'm asking is,
I don't believe it discusses any of this. This is a new manufacturer.
This idea of 336 Barnard having frontage on Charlton Street wasn't an issue until 336 Barnard was actually subdivided from the 123 West Charlton lot, right?
Well, it wasn't even an issue then, because the building didn't have an entrance there, nor did any of the proposed buildings. But the subdivision doesn't change anything, because the section about tithing lots refers to the entire block. So you can divide the building into condos, you can divide the front from the back, you can split it down the middle, you can split off the side yard, and Section B still applies.
How can you divide the rear of the property in a way that it still has, or that its entrance fronts on Charlton Street?
You make it a condo unit. That's one. You sell yourself, or you buy an
easement. That brings me back to the point that the issue arose at the time of subdivision, because at the time of subdivision, it was not made a condo unit.
It had the potential of being a condo unit at the time of the subdivision.
But it wasn't. The approved subdivision was
no. He retained it as additional property under the condo.
Okay, but that was not a condition of the subdivision. It doesn't have to be a part of the condominium.
The subdivision doesn't address the condominium issues at all. The subdivision is a dotted line you draw across your property.
Right. So the issue of whether this is possible and whether 336 Barnard can have an entrance that fronts on Charlton Street arose at the time of subdivision.
No, it arose at the time of the zoning determination. It's never been brought up before.
Was that issue?
It was manufactured by the zoning administrator.
Was that issue raised at the time, directly or on appeal, at the time of the subdivision?
I do not know. I know that I have seen the declaration of condo on the in the deeds records, and I've seen the MPC report on the subdivision, and I've seen the subdivision plat. And I don't think that any of these distinctions are relevant. It's one thing that I mentioned very early on, that there are a lot of arguments that will be introduced to confuse the issue. But we're talking about a tithing block. That's that simple. Subdivision, when it happens, when it doesn't, whatever it is, those are technical details. And in terms of the possibility test, we actually don't know what the possibility test is, because it's not in the statute. It's not defined very clearly in the zoning determination. It's not even clear the way the city applies it, whether you even have to prove anything. You just say, I can't do it. There are a lot of problems with this possibility test. I think you're bringing up some problems with this possibility test. And I think, frankly, it should just be struck down.
Mr. Evans, probably should say this for board discussion, but there's going to be so much input between now and then. I think that the obvious remedy is that if the subdivision of the lot made it unbuildable according to the ordinance, the proper channel would have been to apply for a variance to that ordinance. And that would, therefore, if the variance was approved, allowed entrances to be situated differently than required by the ordinance. That was not done. Are there any other questions for the applicant?
I have a question generally.
Go ahead, Mrs. Jerry.
I don't want to muddy the waters, and I certainly don't want to encourage development along these lines, but doesn't Charleston have houses that face opposite of where the street is? They have their entrance on the side. And wouldn't that resolve this problem?
You mean Charleston?
Charleston. No, I'm talking about the city of Charleston.
The city of Charleston has a different designation.
I understand, and I'm not going there. All I'm just trying to say is, isn't it possible to put the entrance facing Charlton and have a sidewalk going out to Barnard?
Yes. That's what it actually shows on the plat. You can see the path that leads to Charlton, and through the courtyard, there's a path that leads to Barnard.
If they wanted to stay on their own property, couldn't they make a sidewalk from their front door out to Barnard Street?
Yeah, they have. It's here already. It's got a little zig in it. You see, you'd have to go slightly diagonally towards Charlton Street and then zig back a little bit.
Well, but the lines on this map are very unclear to me as to where the subdivision is. And what I'm looking at in Sedges shows that there is a rectangular area. And if they had their front door facing Charlton,
yes. They
could put a sidewalk out and get to Barnard Street.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for the applicant? All right. Is the zoning administrator present? Would you like to come forward? And then, Mr. Lawton, I'll let you read those correspondence.
Pardon me? Good morning. My name is Bridget Lee. I'm the zoning administrator. I'm director of planning and urban design for the city of Savannah. It's good to see you today. Appreciate the presentation that was presented, but I'm going to go ahead and go into where we received the information and made a decision. So just to be clear, within the zoning ordinance in section 3.22, there's a section called written interpretations. This deals specifically with the City of Savannah zoning administrator, who's me, being able to interpret city code based on the provisions here. I'm going to go ahead and read them. The city manager or his or her designee shall be authorized to make all interpretations concerning the provisions of this ordinance as needed. The city manager may confer with the planning director, which would be the MPC director or MPC staff, when rendering an interpretation. Interpretations include, but are not limited to, the text of an ordinance, zoning districts and boundaries, and the use that's not permitted or listed in the ordinance. Once again, the zoning administrator shall render a written interpretation within 30 days of receiving a request, and the zoning confirmation letter that verifies factual information relative to specific property shall be considered as an interpretation of the zoning ordinance. The city manager or his or her designee shall be responsible for zoning confirmation letters. The final action of a written interpretation may be appealed in accordance with section 3.23, which is where we are here today, or why we're here today. As part of this process, there is no requirement to have any public dialogue, public meetings, or anything when interpreting the zoning ordinance according to this section of the code. As Mr. Jones articulated, I'm just going to go ahead and summarize it very quickly. September 2019, the lot was subdivided. December 2020, part one height and mass was approved with conditions, and those conditions had to do with going back and getting a part two design detail. Within the context of part one height and mass, it included the demolition of a non-contributing building, one-story structure, a proposed four-story building as a single family residence, not an accessory dwelling unit, not an accessory structure. And it also included a one-bedroom apartment on the portion of the first floor accessed from the lane. In August 2022, part two, design detail, was presented to the review board. At that time, there were many questions that did come up, and that triggered the generation of a zoning confirmation letter specifically to look at the section 7, 8, 10, G, et cetera, regarding 336 and the orientation of the entrance on the north-south street, which is Barnard Street, versus the east-west streets of Charlton. So these are the regulatory requirements which were highlighted by Mr. Jones. Specifically in the ordinance, the two items that we're looking at is section B, which states tithing blocks A building on the tithing block shall locate its primary entrance to the front, to front the east-west street. And then there's also a provision, number G. If none of the above conditions apply, the building entrance shall be consistent with contributing buildings within the context. That is the determination that the zoning administrator that we made in our office, due to the subdivision of this lot, the primary entrance cannot be located on the east-west streets. There is no frontage on Charlton Street for this property to have an entrance. So therefore, the condition of the tithing block does not exist. And we went ahead and applied letter G. With that being said, letter G looks at buildings that are in the context of the area, and we went ahead and looked at those buildings. And let me just go ahead and go through some of these structures. We looked at the adjacent building to the south at 334 Barnard Street, which was constructed in 1890. This property faces Barnard Street, and it is within the Pulaski Ward area, which is similar to where this subject parcel is located. We also looked at Whitaker Street. There are two parcels here, one constructed in 1852, the other in 1910. Both of these structures are considered contributing. Both of these structures are in the Pulaski Ward and face north-south streets. Moving forward and moving further south down Barnard Street, we looked at Chatham Ward, and there is a structure there at 414 Barnard, which was constructed in 1880, which faces the north-south street. We also looked at, went further on Barnard Street. There are two additional properties that are located on north-south streets, constructed in 1882 and another in 1852. This is in Calhoun Ward. We kind of branched out a little bit, looked at Abercorn Street, found another property that was constructed in 1914. And you can see here, this is in the rear of the tithing lot facing Abercorn Street in Lafayette Ward, right by the cathedral. Two other properties across the street from the cathedral, also constructed in 1888, are considered contributing structures and face Abercorn, that north-south street. Bull Street is a final example that I have for you. Once again, on the rear of a tithing lot, constructed in 1856, a contributing structure that faces the north-south street. With that being said, what I will say in reference to the interpretation of shall, when we look at the language in the ordinance with the letter B, a building on the tithing block shall locate its primary entrance to front east-west streets. The way we look at shall only applies to the extent that compliance is feasible. In this particular circumstance, we felt compliance was not feasible. Therefore, we applied letter G. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'll be more than willing to answer them. I know Bates Levitt, the city attorney, is also here if there are other questions for the city.
Mrs. Liddy, since the putting the entrances as the ordinance states wasn't feasible, why was this not referred to this board for the application for a variance instead of just a determination?
So we were asked for a determination and we gave a determination. Based on our assessment, we felt as though there was no variance that was needed based on the examples that I highlighted, as well as the way the code is written.
Any questions for that zoning administrator? Go ahead, Mrs. Sears.
Was any effort made to contact the National Park Service to see what the implication might be to our landmark status?
No, none was made, because we have examples that show where the entrances are on the north-south streets.
But no examples of recent construction?
No recent construction.
From the time that it became a landmark district?
No, there are plenty of examples. Actually, I've got a list of about 130 properties that I can share with you that highlight where we have properties that face the north-south streets. We have one dated 1915.
Were any of the properties built after the time that it became a landmark district?
Sure. We have one on Houston Street built in 2014.
Okay. Thank you.
So if you would like to see this, I can enter it in as evidence if you want to see it. Not a problem. This was actually pulled together by the review board or the staff here at MPC, Historic Preservation Department.
Any other questions for Mrs. Liddy? All right, Mr. Lawton, do you have something you'd like to read into the record?
Just two things quickly, Mr. Chairman. One, I wanted to respond to the question of variance in case there was any additional thoughts about that. In my opinion, this particular request would not have been variable by this board. This is not something that would have fallen under the purview of the Zoning Board of Appeals to make a variance to the location of the entrance on that property, because that is not a measurable development standard. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Also, I was going to just ask staff to come back to the podium to discuss some of the correspondence that we received prior to this meeting that was not mentioned in the first presentation.
Hold on just a minute. I want to ask you, Mr. Lawton, because I'm curious. Many times when people are not able to easily comply with the requirements of the ordinance, they come for a variance. Why would this one not be subject to a variance or allowed?
Because the location of the doorway, which was what is in question here, is not something that would fall under the purview of this board. It is not a development standard in terms of the measurable development standards in the zoning ordinance that the Zoning Board of Appeals has purview over.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Mr. Lawson, can you tell us how this subdivision happened? Is this going to continue? Are we going to end up with more of these?
Well, under the current subdivision regulations, similar subdivisions could take place.
And the approval process?
I'm sorry?
The approval process?
In this case, this was considered a minor subdivision. So this is a staff level review that gets reviewed by both the MPC staff as well as City of Savannah staff.
Okay. Could we maybe look at minor subdivisions in landmark district?
Well, there has been a lot of discussion about that issue since this petition came forward. A stakeholder group met recently to discuss
that.
And I think there'll be some conversations with the city as a result of that.
Yeah, just to let you all know, there was a meeting last week, and it was a very good meeting in reference to the dialogue that happened. Many stakeholders did come together. We're anticipating a letter from that stakeholder group in order to proceed in possibly looking at making some alternative arrangements with that subdivision process, which is a very good point.
Mrs. Leto, you're going to read.
Yes, sir. There were some letters on the agenda that were attached for letters of support to the appeal that you can review, but also there were letters that were submitted later in the afternoon, yesterday, as well as this morning. And so those had not been published into the agenda. And so I just wanted to state that there were this letter here from Jeff Morgan and Katie Glusica.
Can you clarify? I see on the agenda that it says letter of support for the appeal, and then it says letter to ZBA opposing 336. Which ones supported the appeal and which ones opposed the appeal?
They all are supporting the appeal process.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And then I just wanted to show that, and if you want me to print these out, and I can print them out so you can individually read them, but I just wanted to give you time to review them.
I think I'd like to.
You'll get a chance to speak in just a minute, sir.
How many of these were opposing the alignment of the house, and how many of them were opposing the building, period?
Oh, that's a good question. A lot of them were, talking about the design, against the design and against the subdivision. Some didn't even speak about the appeal, but they were responding to this item.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We're fixing to get into the public comment section. I will strong. You, after public comment, you'll get a chance to rebut. Yes. I will strongly admonish you. The question before this board today is whether or not the determination by the zoning administrator was an error or if it was made correctly. Please limit your comments to that question. We're not here to discuss any other thing, and we're not, the board has no purview over any other part of this. I'll also ask that you keep every person, I'm going to give you 3 minutes to speak and no more, because there's a lot of people here that want to speak. I ask you also, please keep it decent and in order. I want to start on this end of the room and we'll move this way. If you want to speak, raise your hand. Come forward. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, before this young lady comes forward, I just wanted to say that some members of the public who sent me information prior to today, if you have something to present, just let us know and we'll pull it up for you here.
My name is Susan Arden Jolie, and I'm a former resident of Pulaski Square, and I know that ward and that area very well. I've been involved with historic preservation since the days of Lee Adler, when I was an intern for him with Savannah Landmarks, and most recently have served and worked with Christian Sotil at St. John's Church, owned Green Meldrum House as preservationist, and we own property on Pulaski Square, and also was a founding member of the Savannah Antiques and Architecture Weekend, where again we worked with Mr. Sotil. So I'm really here to support the appeal for all the reasons that have been identified. I would like to particularly say that I am pleased you have heard this appeal. This is one only out of the four. I have not read the facts of all of the appeals, but one of the others I have read, and I read the city's response, and it did seem like there was a deliberate misunderstanding of the basis for that appeal, and that's why it was blocked. So thank you and for your work today. I also represent a coalition called the Oglethorpe Plan Coalition, and it's many of us who feel that perhaps there's not sufficient education about what the Oglethorpe Plan is and about the tithing blocks. I lived on a tithing block, and when you buy in that area, you should be aware of what we are trying to preserve in Savannah and what makes our city so precious worldwide. Thank you.
Thank you. Please, okay, come forward.
Anna Havisham Wright. I live on 126 West Taylor Street. Ms. Liddy is claiming almost total control to interpret these ordinances in very arbitrary manner and dilutes their authority, aside from the fact that they are it's all being done in the quiet. My parents bought 128 West Jones Street, right across the street from this, in 1965 as part of Historic Savannah's attempt, very successful attempt, to save Pulaski Square. And it was my aunt bought one across the street in this really wonderful attempt to, and then we got the National Historic Landmark status shortly thereafter. So much work has gone into this fabulous accomplishment of Savannah being as beautiful as it is now. And it should by no means allow this arbitrary destruction of these ordinances. Also, Ms. Liddy's rather troubling justification of just randomly grabbing buildings all over the city and using them as a justification for this very specific site is a complete sabotage of the whole concept of the National Historic Landmark District and the whole way that the ordinance is structured to be site-specific, ward-specific, historically specific. And you cannot go and just do a mix-and-match grab bag, which is what is exemplified by 336. And so this critical reversal of the entrance is just one of many really quite radical and disturbing changes that are being made to the fact that every one of these things is being used as a precedent, and it will just spread incrementally across the city, and that is what is so concerning to the National Park Service. Thank you.
Thank you. Someone else, please raise your hand if you'd like to speak. Come forward, sir.
Board members, I'm David Peterson, 344 Barnard Street. We live immediately to the south of this property. I've been a city engineer. I don't know all the technical details. You're talking about the zoning here as much. It sounds like it's not about the mass and scale of the building, which we have no opposition to, but where the entrance should be. I can tell you our entrance on Barnard Street makes it fun to live on that street, which I think is really important. We talk to our neighbors daily who pass by our street. We get to know people because the entrance is there. And the difference of whether this entrance faces the yard and they don't have access versus the street where you're alive, I don't see how that could be a big component of whether you're meeting the Oglethorpe plan, which I'm not very familiar with. But I can tell you, it feels like community being all located on Barnard Street with the entrance there as a neighbor there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sabrina, will you come forward?
My name is Sabrina Nagel. I live and own property on that block in question where 336 Barnard is being developed. I want to start off by saying that in terms of the appeal, I am in full support of the appeal. There are a few of our neighbors who did not make it today, but have asked me to please just count them in the record as supporting this appeal against this development. That's Mark Hill, who lives on West Charlton Lane. That's Melanie Moran on 350 Barnard Street. Jeff and Lynn Morgan, who did send in something written but could not be here. And then there's Beth and Tim Guardoro, who lives at 214 West Jones Street. So part of what I wanted to say in support of this appeal was that in Mr. Evans, to kind of touch back to what Mr. Evans has said, part of the problem is when this lot was subdivided, all of these problems happened, but none of them, I don't think, were brought up. And if they were, we don't know. It was done behind closed doors. None of the neighbors on that block knew about the lot subdivision at all. There was no notice. There was no information. We just didn't know that. If we go back to September of 2017, this is super important because this is how it all started. Whoops, that's not mine. This is kind of when it all started to be weird. Thank you. I need to just enlarge that. When this all started, we were given a notice, and we were very happy as neighbors and direct people who live in that block to hear, to have a notice, to know what's going on, right? They had requested a variance. That is up to smarter people to figure out why they requested this variance. But their notice was they were going to build a four-unit carriage house slash garage. This was the only notice that was ever given to any of us who live on that block. Of course, we were all really happy about a new carriage house being built there. None of us are really defending a cinder block structure that's there. That's not what this is about. But we were thinking it was going to be a carriage house. And where I'm thinking that this all happened was they requested the variance to be able to probably figure out how they were going to have that access. I don't know. That's such an assumption. And then somehow they waited strategically until Nuzo in 2019. Oh, by the way, this went nowhere. I can't find a trace of where it went. I can't find a trace when it was ever heard. I don't know exactly what happened to it. I think it was retracted. They just quietly disappeared it. Then Nuzo, they kind of, to me, it seems like they waited for Nuzo, which happened in 2019, and exactly about like 1 month later, they subdivide the lot under all of our noses. Nobody knew about it. Nobody told us about it. We had no idea it had happened. So, of course, here we are thinking, well, this is going to be a two-story carriage house. But in reality, behind the scenes, zoning was creating an exemption for this lot to be subdivided and all the rules to fly out the window. This wasn't fair to those of us who live there, because the next thing we know, there's a rendering on that little cinder block building with this huge house that we're like, where did this come out of? But we're thinking, no, 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 we're safe because this can't fly here. This has got to be a two-story carriage house. It's a lane, right? There's the Oglethorpe plan, there's MPC, there's all these people that are going to protect us. That didn't happen. There were two COAs, both of which occurred during the crazy mess of COVID. And they were, I believe both, if not at least the first one was virtual. I spoke up on that. I presented issues of only those of us who live there would kind of know, which is a huge problem with the sanitation of the original main house. So the original main house being 123 West Charlton, that building is five apartments. Five apartments creating trash. There is a dumpster belonging to Brad Bauch, has his name on it, in the back of that cinder block building, as well as four bins.
Mrs. Nagel.
Yes.
I'm sorry, but we're at the 3 minutes. And
I will make it brief. This was what was presented to us. I just want to notate that this is what to the left, this little building was what was on that request and what actually ended up happening. There were one of my most important points was the standards that applied for this initial request for this carriage house were very strict on the height. So I know that this appeal is not about the height, but I just want to mention everybody should probably look at that. To look at what the staff recommendations were on that building versus the staff recommendations on the much taller building, which I'm not sure why they didn't apply. Those standards just didn't apply. And, you know, this is what it currently stands at. And please forgive my use of Mr. Sotile's beautiful drawing and what happens to that space. The void is completely filled. And in terms of how did this happen? In terms of the actual appeal, what is relevant? Well, it wouldn't have if that lot subdivision had been either notified, brought out to the public, or we'd known about it, we would have all pointed that out. It was very easy to point out that this lot subdivision would have been a problem, but that was done behind closed doors. We had no way of giving input for that. So that's really, in a nutshell, what I wanted to say. There are a lot of us who support this appeal and who oppose this, a lot of people who have jobs and just can't make it here, but I'm happy to be able to speak on their behalf. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there another member of the public that would like to speak? Come forward, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Ernest Wood, excuse me, I've been losing my voice. Past decisions to ignore the Oglethorpe plan do not justify continuing to do that again. Two wrongs or 120 wrongs do not make a right. It's my understanding that the pattern language of the Oglethorpe plan dictates that tithing lot homes shall face east-west streets with primary structures up to four stories high. The rear of these homes shall have space for outdoor gardens beyond which secondary building shall be two stories. The first level shall be for carriages, now cars, and the second floors for modest affordable residences. The proposed primary residence, primary on this secondary lot, is 33% more than the code permits. If NUSO has amended this, if the Chadbourne guidelines have been eliminated from our code, then this is a grave error. However, what does exist in our code as of today is that the overall height of a building and the height of individual components of a building or structure shall be visually compatible to the contributing buildings and structures to which it is visually related. The proposed home is attractive, but to my eyes, it in no way visually is compatible with the contributing buildings and structures to which it would be visibly related. No longer will the corner house have a little courtyard space and a carriage house garage with a small one-story living space above. It will have no connection to the lane, which is vital for the corner lot owners, parking, pickup and delivery, garbage can placement and removal. Further, I remind you that the this structure is permitted, the precedent it will set will activate the loss of the Oglethorpe plan like a house of cards. Each ward has 16 corner lots. We have 22 wards. That makes 351 more potential subdivided lots and three-story homes replacing two-story carriage houses. The National Park Service is watching us. Its classification of historic significance is satisfactory, watch, threatened, emergency. We are next to the bottom in this ranking. The loss of national historic status would be incalculable. The Oglethorpe Plan has served us well for almost three centuries as a uniquely functional and beautiful urban design. Do not let this be the cause of its demise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Wood. If you want to speak, raise them high. All right, sir, you.
My name is Vance Peacock, the owner of 120 West Jones LLC, the owner of 120 West Jones Street, and my carriage house shares Charlton Lane with 336 Barnard, the property in question today. I'm a native of Savannah and also a ward captain for Pulaski Square. I don't know the owner of 336 Barnard, nor its developer or its investors, but they appear to be getting special treatment from the zoning administrator and the MPC. One has to ask the question, why is the zoning board and why is MPC working to compromise our historic district, further threatening the National Park Service's designation for Savannah, which could eliminate tax credits and lower property values? What does it take for the zoning board and the MPC to perform their duty of applying the laws equitably and prudently to preserve the integrity of our historic district? The process is broken, in my opinion, and we're all going to regret the reckless decisions of our bureaucrats. I also have to ask why citizens like myself are having to come forward and police these city departments that should be protecting the historic property and protecting the Oglethorpe plan, or at least what's left of it. We citizens are having to fight the zoning board and MPC to force them to reverse their unlawful acts and reverse further downgrades in our national historic landmark status. We need people of integrity here, guys, to run the zoning board and MPC and the people of integrity on the boards of these departments that will not squander the historic value of our city. And I will and will ensure that future generations will recognize Savannah as originally laid out or close to it by General Oglethorpe. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Come forward, sir.
My name's Paul Cobay. I live at 531 East Perry Street, which is happens to be a tithing block that does qualify for subdivision. I think at the end of the day, what we really need to be focused on is the fact that based upon the approval of this development, the National Historic Park Service stood up and threw a yellow flag out on the playing field and basically said, guys, you're not being a really good steward of the Landmark Historic District. And this, you guys, this is the opportunity to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, we really need to pay attention to what these guys are saying because they grant historic status and they can revoke historic status. And we've had warning letters before. So continuing to base decisions to grant or to approve projects based upon a litany of exceptions that had already been granted, that's a slippery slope. And at some point, if you don't draw a line in the sand, you continue down that downward path and we'll lose our historic status. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Ledvina. I'm a resident of the Downtown Historic District, and I support this appeal. I support the other three appeals that I'm hoping in the name of transparency will be presented to the Zoning Review Board. I am not a resident of Pulaski Square. However, what happens in Pulaski Square will happen in Troop Square, and it will continue to happen throughout the National Landmark Districts in the city of Savannah. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next? Raise your hand, please. Mr. Yellen, come on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I represent the owner of 336 Barnard, I'd like to ask for a few extra minutes. And Mr. Ball has agreed to let me have his minutes as well, and I can speak.
I don't know. I think y'all are speaking as members of the public. So y'all get 3 minutes like everyone else.
All right. I know that Mr. Jones had a very long period of time to present his appeal.
He's the applicant.
I understand, but there are a number of things that do need to be addressed. Let's see if I can at least get the exhibits up. Thank you. As you are now aware, the MPC approved the subdivision of this property in 2019. It approved height and mass in 2020, and at that time, we fronted Barnard Street. There was no appeal of our Part 1 height and mass, and HRB approved Part 2 on September 14th. In approving the design of the single family residence, the historic preservation staff agreed with the zoning administrator. And the only issue, the one and only issue before you today is, did the zoning administrator err in her determination? I'm going to skip through and go straight to the ordinance. This ordinance must be based on the plain language before you, not based on what Mr. Jones or anyone else would like for it to say. Subsection B says, you've seen it. Subsection G says, you've seen it. The only access for this parcel is to a lane, and under our ordinance, a lane is not a street. I think you all know that. The nearest street is Charlton Street. We cannot go to Charlton Street. We don't have access, and we do not front on Charlton Street, so condition B does not apply. Mr. Jones believes that subsection B, or the shall, trumps the shall of subsection G. In my trade, I commonly use words like notwithstanding anything to the contrary, or notwithstanding the foregoing. And this ordinance says if none of the above conditions apply, the building entrance shall be consistent with contributing buildings within the context. And that is exactly what we did. Somehow what I'm hearing from both the appellant and other members of the audience is that we should be required to build a carriage house on this lot. And we're prohibited from building single family residential on Barnard. And it's true, a lot of people do prefer a carriage house. But I have scoured the city ordinance. There is absolutely no requirement that we must build a carriage house on this lane. And to the contrary, there are 162 buildings on tithing lots with a primary entrance on a north-south street. And this is not my map. This is a map of the preservation officer and her staff. So I would submit that the appellant's reading of the city ordinance is not only inconsistent with the plain language of the ordinance, it's inconsistent with a pattern of contributing buildings in the historic district. And to Ms. Jarrett's point, you'll see at the bottom, these buildings were built in the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, and in 2000. Mr. Jones is certainly aware of this pattern. One of the 162 buildings is his. Or perhaps an affiliated company of his. This was his petition of several months ago for his building that faces Haversham Street. And this, of course, is the street view of his carriage house that faces the North South Street right behind Berrien House, which incidentally, he did a magnificent job of renovating. Beautiful. It was outstanding. But it begs the issue because he doesn't show you the Oglethorpe plan. He shows you the evolution of the Oglethorpe plan. The Berrien House faces Broughton Street. The carriage house faces Haversham. The 1891 map, I was respectful. I would ask that you do the same. I'm so sorry, but the audience could refrain from responding to my comments. Again, in 1891, Berrien House faces.
Mr. Yellen.
Ma'am, sir.
You're at 5 minutes already.
I will do my best to conclude then. Dr. Goble was unable to be here. For the record, I will submit his resume, a four-page resume. For your review, I will leave with you his conclusion that the end lot of every tithing row also has frontage on a north-south street, and they have an opportunity for a third direction. Again, I'll let you look at the highlighted sections, but I'd like to make one last comment and then I will sit down. I think everything that I've discussed so far is before you, but maybe the reason we're here is the issue not before you, and that's subdivision. Whether this lot should or should not have been subdivided in the first place, but I would submit to you that this property was subdivided. It was legally subdivided. It was approved by the Planning Commission. It was approved by the city engineer. It was approved by the executive director of the MPC. And with that subdivision comes fundamental property rights that simply cannot be taken away. If the issue is let's not subdivide anymore, that's beyond the purview of what you're doing today. Let's create a new text amendment. Let's amend NUZO. Let's say that tithing lots can't be subdivided. But the petition before you today is a legally subdivided lot of record. So I respect Mr. Jones. He has exercised his right to appeal. We respect that right. We really do. He has the burden of proof. He has to prove an error on the part of the zoning administrator in reaching her findings. And he has not proved that case. He's proved that he doesn't like our petition. He's not proved his case. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else like to speak? Come on, Mr. Steele.
Turn. Good morning. I'm Christian Sotile, and appreciate being here. I'm pleased to have an opportunity to share just a little bit of additional background and facts about the project with you. We have been working on this project for more than 2 years, and it has been fully approved by the Historic District Board of Review, both unanimously for Part 1, height, mass, and orientation, and recently to conclude for the Part 2 design details. The appeal before you today is somehow an attempt to reverse the approval of a design, which is very disheartening. What I'd like to do, recognizing our limited time, is really just focus on that one question about the north-south entrances. I was going to provide just a bit of review about the project, but I'm going to jump ahead here. So the recent discussion is whether or not a building should have a front door, and that's what brings us here this morning. And with that in mind, I have to make a few remarks about that question and the patterns of the Oglethorpe plan. As an urban designer, as an educator, as a practitioner, I've dedicated my entire professional career to defending the Oglethorpe plan. And our work in Savannah goes back more than 20 years when we worked closely with the city to update and calibrate the height development map and later work with the city again very carefully on new standards to regulate large-scale development within the district. So I'm proud to say we authored the first language in our historic district ordinance that explicitly spells out preservation of the Oglethorpe plan. Our city plan is unquestionably a resource, but to honor it, we must respect its layered complexity and the lessons that it offers as a living city. Corner lots within the Oglethorpe plan have naturally developed with a wider range of building patterns. There's a natural diversity created in corner lot conditions due to the fact that they have frontage on both east-west and north-south streets. Historic maps taken anywhere throughout the historic district display this pattern clearly. This map example from 1916, we can see buildings fronting north-south streets in every instance circled. This is not a bad thing. This is a very good thing. It means that our streets and our sidewalks are activated with building entrances rather than blank walls. So the staff at the MPC, as you've seen, have done some hard work recently to document this. This map shows more than 160 examples. So we talk about integrity of the Oglethorpe Plan. We have to look at it for what it is. So I can't show you all these buildings, but I do have to say this. If we accept the premise of what some of what we've been hearing today, then what we're saying is that we have been doing this wrong for a very long time. That's very upsetting to me as an urbanist and a professional here in Savannah. So this building, for example, we've been doing it wrong since the 1700s. And I've learned this recently listening to the opposition. Buildings that we've come to know and love, built during the 18th and 19th centuries on into the 20th century, have apparently not gotten the memo about the Oglethorpe Plan. Some of the finest buildings in the city apparently are not good enough anymore. In fact, listening to a recent meeting, I heard that if these buildings were to burn, we should not allow them to be replaced. And this includes some grand public buildings like we just saw, but also some really simple residential buildings. This one's actually a very good example because it's nearly identical to the building that we've been working on for 2 years on Barnard Street. Apparently that's not correct. Independent Presbyterian Church, I've always thought to be a really fine building, but we have to rethink it now, apparently. Buildings on Abercorn Street, another building on Abercorn Street, building on Whitaker Street, buildings on Barnard Street. In fact, within eye distance of our site, double trouble here. And then as was noted earlier, our next door neighbor, another building I've always admired. So it's unfortunate. Another massing example, very similar to our new structure, and another.
Mr. Steele, we're at 4 minutes now.
Okay, let me just conclude. Sorry, some people have made important decisions in some of these problematic buildings. Our very local context is here. It is a one-story building. I would point out it has an entrance on the north-south street already. We might just assume common sense would lead us to say, of course it does. I will close with, certainly we could talk about the project all day. I appreciate the time to share that with you. I do believe our ordinance makes perfect sense as written. We have applied for no variances. We've applied for no exceptions. I was in the room when the ordinance was written. I know what it means. And Section G is for this very thing. There's no way to possibly document the layers of complexity in the Oglethorpe Plan. That's why it's so good. And that's why you have to write a clause like G so that you can allow it to continue to be good. If we tried to document every layer of complexity in the plan, we would have a 400-page document, which we actually tried to do when we spent a year working on the ordinance about 12 years ago. So I'll close with that. I appreciate everyone's time. I appreciate your clear thinking and common sense. And of course, happy to answer any questions.
Any other members of the public like to speak? Come forward, sir.
I'm John Brown, resident of the city for many, many years. And I'd like to support the appeal Mr. Jones presented. And it seems like that a lot of the argument here is in favor of building this house is of past buildings that faced in the wrong directions. And we do have those precedents, but there needs to be a time when we stop that because it's becoming now a problem, not only because of the historic landmark district, but parking problems. And I think that we need to say enough. And that's basically what I'm saying. And one thing, you know, we don't know about things that are going on. MPC, zoning board, they do things we don't know anything about. It's behind closed doors. And one person or two people just declares it's okay. So what's going on? Why are we not informed of what's going on? So let's just put a stop to this. This was one simple thing. Just turn it down. You can't build it. And no more of them. No more subdivision of lots. Stop it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members of the public would like to speak? Last chance. All right, Mr. Jones, would you like to rebut public comment?
Certainly. Obviously, a great deal of the public comment was in support of the appeal. I think this is actually a very constructive dialogue. I think it shows the importance of this particular group in getting these issues brought to light. So Mr. Sotil brings up the fact that this is a living city. It's changed a lot. And yes, there are a lot of magnificent buildings that violate the Oglethorpe plan. That's true. But Savannah's a little bit unique. And maybe it's not the way that Mr. Sotil or others want it, but in 1966, the designation was based largely on the Oglethorpe plan and the extent to which areas outside the original four squares echoed the Oglethorpe plan. And it's repeated over and over and over throughout the designation. Now, that's a different type of designation than Savannah's designated as a landmark because it's got great old buildings and it's got incredible history and it's such a vibrant and interesting city. That is not the type of designation Savannah has. Whether, you know, that decision was right or wrong is something that's too late to debate. That all happened in 1966. So if we want to keep our status, we keep our status according to the guidelines in the original designation, which means we've got to protect the Oglethorpe plan and the pure Oglethorpe plan, not this altered plan. And the NPS, which interprets that designation, has made it clear. Again, page 52 of the 2018 report warns us about filling the voids between principal buildings and rear lane buildings. So while Mr. Sotile's revisionist theory is a theory worth contemplating, it's not the one that we've got before us. We can't even use that theory because the designation is based upon a very strict Oglethorpe plan theory. So that also means that all these wonderful pictures of buildings that have their doors on the north-south street, they're existing. And as we saw in the statute for entrances and doors, there's a totally separate section for existing buildings. That's why. And then there are much stricter standards for new construction. Why? Because we were new construction is under these severe restrictions in order to protect and restore the Oglethorpe plan. The designation actually talks about restoring the Oglethorpe plan. So we're stuck in the 66 designation. Therefore, all of these comparables, you know, it's an interesting theory. It's worth knowing, but it's just not relevant to what we're addressing there. And it's not relevant with Ms. Liddy's analysis because she's using those comparables under the assumption that you fall under G, that catch-all phrase. The comparables are not relevant under Section B. Section B is just terribly clear. If you're in a tithing block, you shall locate your entrance on the east-west street. Ms. Liddy also relied on the interpretation of the shall clause as not being mandatory, but being subject to this possibility test that she can use to nullify the provisions of the law. And that's not in the law. She also talked about the October 17th meeting, which was very productive. There was violent agreement among all the stakeholders of what the next step should be. But what's the point of changing the law if Ms. Liddy's office can just nullify it and come up with these closed door interpretations of the law that render it meaningless for her favorite developers? And then there's this general theory that bad things justify more bad things. That would be like saying that there are 48 murders in Savannah last year, so 50, 60, that would be just fine this year. It's a silly argument, and it's inconsistent with the designation. Let's go to Mr. Yellen's arguments. I agree with him. Today we're not talking about height and mass. A lot of issues we're not talking about. We're actually not talking about subdivision. And his arguments, again, go to this possibility test, which is so complicated. We spent a lot of time arguing about what it meant. Nobody knows what this possibility test is or what the standards are. And it's not even in the ordinance. So frankly, you should cast it down. I mean, it creates a whole can of worms. And it's not even there in the ordinance. Mr. Yellen says that a carriage house is being required. We're not requiring a carriage house. I'm sure that Mr. Sotil is very capable designing a fantastic building that on this lot that could conform with the ordinance. I'm sure that he's perfectly able to do that. And it doesn't have to be a carriage house. It can be a single family house, but it just has to respect the ordinance. Again, Mr. Yellen cited 162 buildings. Again, bad stuff justifies more bad stuff. That assumes that that section G applies, which we argue it doesn't. And so it's that revisionist theory. That's not the theory that the designation is based on. Then he cites my carriage house. And yes, my carriage house has a door on the North-South Street. Absolutely. It's an example of one of those buildings that didn't follow the Oglethorpe plan. It's quite a hodgepodge. But in a way, it does follow the Oglethorpe plan because it actually has a main entrance on the courtyard. It has that additional entrance on the side, but it has an entrance in the courtyard. It does face the east-west street. Why do carriage houses have that? Because if you're going out to the carriage house in the middle of the night to get a sip of Madeira, you keep all your booze in the back, you're not going to walk outside of your house onto the sidewalk and go onto the north-south street and then enter into your carriage house. You go out the back door of your main house and you go in the door of the carriage house that faces the courtyard. In a way, my carriage is actually an example where the main door actually faces the front house east-west. Under subdivision, subdivision does give you fundamental property rights. Of course it does, but it gives you fundamental property rights within the law. Just because you subdivide doesn't mean suddenly you're exempt from the provisions that are in question here today. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. At this point, we're going to enter into board discussion. There will be no more testimony or public comment whatsoever. Mrs. Jones.
I don't have any comment.
Okay. Mr. Hall, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No, sir.
Mr. Condon.
I think that there's been some tremendous articulate spokespeople that have presented with us for the last 2 hours, and I thank them for doing so today. I think that many people have unfortunately overlooked that the scope of what we have to look at today is limited to just one thing. Did the zoning administrator make a mistake? And looking at what she uses for the criterion for making her decisions, it's completely obvious to me that she's not going to take into consideration, well, maybe this could happen, or maybe that could happen, or maybe the guy could ask for permission to walk through another person's property and so on to be able to have a side entrance. The reality is that she has before her a question that she must answer based on the information that is provided to her and the facts as she understands them, and not whether or not the same LLC owns both parcels. One has nothing to do with the other. And to tell you the absolute truth, having listened to everything, I can see no mistake that the zoning administrator made. She interpreted the rule based on the ordinance as it's currently written. And so as a result of that, I can certainly feel for folks who are worried about overdevelopment and this type of thing. I get it, I certainly do, but that's not what we're here to talk about. And we're not allowed to venture into that. We're here really to speak about just that one thing. And I think the zoning administrator acted correctly. I don't see any mistake on her part.
Okay, Mr. Plunk.
I was going to ask first, do we know if Mr. Evans stepped out and will he be coming back shortly? I wanted to make sure before we...
Mr. Evans had to excuse himself. He would not be returning.
Okay, thank you. And then the other thing, I mean, as often happens, Mr. Condon took the words right out of my mouth. I think there are a lot of pressing matters that have been brought to this board's attention today. A lot, and I'll add my voice to the weight of those who are saying that clearly something needs to be done on some of these subdivision issues, on some of these other issues that have been brought up repeatedly throughout the last 2 hours. But at the end of the day, even the letter from the National Park Service is ultimately irrelevant to the issue before us as to whether or not Mrs. Liddy erred in her judgment. And I guess that's all I've got to add because you said everything else.
Mrs. Jarrett?
I'm afraid I disagree with my colleagues. I guess I have spent enough time in Charleston to know that there are other ways that we could have constructed this house. And I feel like the ordinance does use the word shall, and that should have been taken into consideration. I think the bigger error here, though, is the fact that we subdivided a tithing lot and created the situation that is before us. So that's it.
I'd like to say that I agree with the two of y'all in that there is one question before us, whether or not the determination was an error or not. But I agree with Mrs. Jarrett that it specifically says this is a tithing lot, then it applies. And regardless, there's nothing else to consider. It's a tithing lot. The ordinance says the entrances should face a certain way, period. Not, well, it can't be, or, you know, it was created, the situation was created when it was subdivided. That's not before us. The ordinance says a certain thing, and there's no reason it can't be complied with. That said, would someone like to make a motion?
I was just going to add on that I suppose I was fairly convinced by Mr. Evans' argument that in a situation, as Mr. Condon said, it's not up to the zoning administrator's purview to consider whether one lot or another is owned by the same or different people. And so if this was a situation in which the front lot was not owned by the same person, it would very clearly not be possible, because there's no frontage on that street, it would very clearly not be possible to build there. And so the shall would clearly not be relevant here. And so I think we can't take that into consideration when creating a precedent. And if you understand, Mr. Condon, do you get what I'm saying here?
No, I fully understand. When you're looking at the lot by itself on the plat without consideration for the building that's in front of it, that particular lot does not face Charlton. It just doesn't. It faces Barnard. And as a result of that, looking at it from that perspective, I don't see how you'd look at it and think to yourself that because it's a tithing lot that it should face onto Charlton. It just, as a, you know, from my perspective, looking at it and trying to put myself in the place of the zoning administrator, I would have looked at it and said, there is no frontage, so there is no way for us to do it. And the, you know, putting a doorway on the side of a building, you know, I suspect that, you know, that when push comes to shove, if they need to put a doorway on the side of a building, they're going to do it. But at the end of the day, it's not something in her purview. It's not something that she should have been considering as to whether or not this should be approved. I think that there's a lot of emotion in this thing, and that people have certain feelings about, you know, what's going on in the Landmark District. And, you know, believe me, I'm with you. I just don't think in this particular instance that she should be taking into account the fact that the building in front of her faces one way, when you look and historically 100 plus properties were built prior to the approval by the National Park Service of our designation, you know, that do the exact same thing as this building would do. So I you know,
it also seems to me that this would create a scenario in which if the ownership of these two lots was ever to not be shared, it could create a huge problem if in the future someone said, no, we will not share common space. Suddenly, I don't even know what would happen in that situation.
And that happens all the time. You know, when you have situations where you have a handshake deal or an understanding, and then the ownership changes, and no, you can't walk through my path to get to the beach, right? You hear about these types of things all the time. I think it's a slippery slope if we go down into this thing where the administrator has to be thinking about who owns both parcels. Is there a possibility of doing this, or should we be looking at side entrances and so on, when the question really was asked, you know, does it have to comply when there is no frontage facing Charlton? That's just my
opinion. A side entrance doesn't require that he walk through that property.
I agree with you there. Okay. I agree with you there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Would someone care to make a motion?
I motion that we deny the petitioner's request.
Okay, Mr. Plunk has made a motion to deny the petitioner's request to appeal the decision of the zoning administrator. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Condon. Is there any discussion on the motion? All right, Mrs. Jones, how do you vote?
No.
Mr. Hall?
No.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mrs. Jarrett?
No.
Okay, and Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Okay, we have three yeses, or two yeses and three noes. The motion fails. Would someone else care to make a motion?
Move to approve the applicant's appeal.
Okay, Mrs. Jarrett has made a motion to approve the applicant's appeal to the determination by the zoning administrator. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Seconded by Mrs. Jones. Is there any discussion on the motion? All right, Mrs. Jones, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Hall?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
No.
Mr. Plunk?
No.
Mrs. Jarrett?
Yes.
Okay, there's three yeses and two noes. The motion passes, and the appeal to the determination by the zoning administrator is upheld. I think there needs to be a little more than just, I mean, where does this go from here? Because we, as in the staff report, we have the authority to act in place of do we send this back to the historic review board? I mean, this throws a lot of stuff into the mix here. I think there needs to, the more guidance that we can give this, the less controversy and confusion there'll be down the line.
Move to send it back to the historic district review board in order for them to determine an alignment that meets with.
So would this be to rehear parts one, height and mass, and start over?
Aye.
All right. Mrs. Jarrett has made a motion to.
Not the height and mass, but you're talking about the entrance.
Now. Yes, entrance.
The entrance.
Yeah. The height and
mass. Yeah, that's. So, well, the entrances on a building, I believe, are part of part one, height and mass.
They'll have to address that. I'm just trying to refine the motion because I'm in support of it. So we want to send it back to those guys to address the entrance issue.
Yes.
Because that's what we hear about.
The issue that brought this whole problem to a head.
Is I'd like some is Leah Mahalik still in here?
Yeah, she should have stayed in here.
Leah, we're in the midst of making a motion about sending this.
Name.
Okay.
What is the question for me?
So just go ahead, Mrs. Jarrett.
I think that the goal is to move the entrance to the side of the building.
Yeah, I don't know how that's visually compatible.
Can I say something, Mr. Chairman? I think what the board is considering right now, having made one motion, is they're considering additional motion to remand the petition back to the review board for the purpose of reconsidering the entrance location based on the denial of the zoning administrator's letter. Yeah. In other words, I think you all have determined with your first vote that the letter was an error, and based on that, would like the board to reconsider the entrance location.
Yeah, it has to be because of the motion that passed, it's been determined that I think that section B, that the tithing lot entrances have to face, what is it?
The east-west street.
Yeah.
The applicant could also apply for a special exception from that standard, it's not a variance because variances come to you all, but they could apply for a special exception to the review board from that standard.
Okay. Well then.
So
that's not what they did though, is it?
No, because the zoning administrator determined that G was applicable. So now they would have to do that though.
Okay.
Either that or change the configuration.
Yeah.
Your motion could be that it goes back to the review board for reconsideration in light of the determination by this board.
That sounds good to me.
Okay. So Mrs. Jarrett has made a motion to remand us back to the historic review board to be reconsidered in light of the determination by the ZBA. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Is there any discussion on this motion? All right, hearing none. Mrs. Jones, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Hall? Mr. Hall? Mr. Condon, how do you vote?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mrs. Jared?
Yes.
Mr. Hall, are you there? Is he muted?
No, he's gone.
All right, well, there are four votes in favor, so the motion passes, and this petition, or the 331 Barnard Street is remanded back to the Historic Review Board for reconsideration. All right, moving on, before we adjourn, we're getting coming up on December very fast, and I'd like to say I've enjoyed chairing this board, and I am perfectly willing to continue doing that, but me personally, I'm very much in favor of term limits for every part of governance. So this is the October meeting. If there's anyone that would like to chair this board or would like to make a nomination for somebody to do that, we will hold nominations next month and elections in December. So be thinking about that, and you know, I'm good with whatever y'all want to do. Well, you can do that. All right. There's no further business, so I will call this meeting adjourned.